poet Garrett Hongo writes of American Flamingo, right here, which was just published this year by Southern Illinois University Press, just across the river. Quote, "I can as easily do without Greg Pape's poems as the high deserts and mountains of which he writes can do without rain and lightning." Hongo is right to point, oh, that's the end of the quote. Hongo is right to point out these things, for Greg Pape, more than almost any poet I can think of, is a poet of place. From Washington, D.C. to California, from South Florida to the Bitterroot Mountains. He is practically the official international spokesperson for any place, as he observes and empathizes, and even when crossing borders, makes almost any place his home and articulates it simply and elegantly to the rest of us. In these many places he visits, Greg Pape delights in the big symbols, odd archetypes, and ambiguous parables, and his poems are filled with Native American snakes etched on sandstone disks, Studebakers cabled together to prevent a river's erosion, a 4.6 billion year old meteorite darkened with generations of oil from human hands. He also tells about the animals in these places, and his poems are filled with owls, moose, anis, or is it anis? Anis. Those bird things. Flamingos, which for the record, Greg, do not taste like chicken. Hogs, mallards, and 21st century dogs. With his keen and ever unjudging eye, Greg Pape discerns these places of vital connectedness. Our human connections, one to another, as well as community, and also connections to nature, to the wilderness, to rivers and mountains and deserts, to the wildlife and the pets, and ultimately, to the world. Greg Pape is the author of four other books of poetry, Border Crossings, Black Branches, Storm Pattern, and Sunflower Facing the Sun. His poems have appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, the New Yorker, Poetry, Colorado Review, and many years ago, before my time, so I can't take credit, River Styx. The recipient of the Richard Hugo Memorial Poetry Award, a Pushcart Prize, and the Edwin Ford Piper Poetry Award, he teaches in the writing program at the University of Montana and in the brief residency program at Spalding University. He lives with his family in the Bitterroot Valley. Please welcome my good friend and former teacher, Greg Pape.
Thank you very much. I'm going to jump around a little bit here start with an older poem called To a Woman on the Local News. And watching the local news in Missoula, Montana, it's kind of a shoddy operation, but so you can see behind the scenes a little bit sometimes. And this was... Just one night I was watching the news, and this woman and her story caught my attention. To a woman on the local news. Dressed in jailhouse orange, you explained to the judge you thought you were fleeing Satan's agents in those flashing cars. You explained how your boyfriend dumped you and took up with a witch. You knew he didn't know what he was doing, but when you went over to straighten him out, she put a curse on you. And they'd been after you ever since. From Florence to Lolo, you eluded them with hard driving. You'd seen enough chase scenes to know it could be done. The sheriff cleared the way ahead and lay a carpet of nails across the road. Two tires blew. But you were scared and kept that U-Haul floored around the bends and down the straightaway for Missoula. At the corner of Reserve and Purgatory, you made a hard left into the roadblock that slowed you down enough for one of them to break out your shotgun window before you slammed a patrol car out of the way and headed across town toward the interstate. I wonder if the judge believed even part of your story. I wonder if you realize now the man who shot out your last two tires and finally ran you off the road was working for the other side. On TV, you fluffed your hair and asked, "Am I going to be on TV?" Your mad eyes and girlish smile hit me like a truck, and I fell for you, though you looked like hell. Where are you now? What happened to your boyfriend and the witch? We never got the whole story. Are they watching you in Warm Springs? That's the state mental hospital. Are you closed in a cell, replaying your wildest day like a bad movie that keeps ending with someone like you lying on a bed of nails? Or are you out of jail, looking now out of someone else's eyes? I'm not reading out of one book. I'm jumping around here, so bear with me a moment here. I was thinking about, I was just talking to John Tribble, my editor at Southern Illinois University Press. He's saying that the next issue of Crab Orchard is going to be about defining family. And I think this has been a subject of my poetry for a long time, trying to define family. And this poem has to do with being a father and a father of boys. I've got two sons. And this is back when, back in the sleepover days, you know, when the guys, all their buddies would come over and sleep over. And this is like the morning after the sleepover, Saturday morning. A house full of boys, wild boys growling like dogs, galloping across the living room floor, bouncing on the couch with a gorilla grace, blasting each other with pillows and sleeping bags. Blake said, "Exuberance is beauty," and I can see it. But at some point, they will have to be cautioned, urged in the direction of restraint, and soon. More and more, I have come to love the stillness of morning, the opening of day, like the turning of a page in a story I can't stop writing. All the wise teachers say, include the difficulties in the work. Keep your practice going. So I will begin now to simmer the bacon. I will mix the batter, fill the glasses with cold juice of apples, oranges. I will warm the maple syrup the way my grandmother did. And if I raise my voice, it will not be to scold, but to call them with exuberance to breakfast. And the place where I live in the Bitterroot Valley is, it's a beautiful place, and I live up on a ridge, and I have a little study, a little shack out in the back of my house that has windows facing south. And I can look, on a clear day, I can look down the Bitterroot Valley, see the Bitterroot Mountains going south, the Sapphire Mountains on the other side going south, and I can see about 70 miles down the valley. It's really an incredible view. And I spend a lot of time, when I'm trying to think of something to write, I spend a lot of time staring out the window. And sometimes I'll find a poem out there, you know, in the air. And this one I did, this is called Spring Storm. Just a little poem. A pause in the light, in bird song. The weightless end of an hour falls. A storm blows in over the Bitterroots. Wind pushes flurries into the silvery valley light, finding voice in bare limbs of cottonwoods, already budding, waving, humming low notes under the green brushes of pines. All down the valley, doors are closing. All down the valley, horses are turning east as a backlit curtain of snow closes on the southern vista. One gray and black bear paw Appaloosa on a fenced half acre runs tight circles in the dirt, throwing its head, shaking its mane, rocking forward, cocking its spotted haunches, kicking the teeth out of the wind. And this one, this is another one. This is a little bit longer poem, and this is going to take a little bit of bearing with, because it has some transitions in it. In this poem, it's called Remember the Moose. And I think of the poem as it's two things. It's telling a little story. It tells an anecdote. But at the same time, I'm kind of meditating on a subject and thinking about it. So I'm going back and forth between telling the story and going back into memory and thinking about it. So it might, if you get confused, that's okay. It'll all come through. Remember the moose. I think, can you picture a moose? They're huge. They're bigger than horses. And They're beautiful in a homely sort of way. They're very impressive creatures. They're also dangerous. You know, you don't want to go up and try to pet a moose. She must have come down from high mountain meadows where bear grass blooms had dried and fallen. Paintbrush put away its colors, and mud wallows begun to freeze and stay frozen past noon. Down along the creek, through aspen, alder, and willow thickets, to high grass along a road leading to town. Why she kept on coming, you can only guess. Rich green smell of cemetery grass, muted bellow of a distant bull, old path imprinted in her genes, deep doubts, simple curiosity. Maybe she was lost, or came as a reminder of something lost. A moose grazing among the graves on Sunset Hill is an image one might hold for years, turning it over and over, working it into a story, or finding it strangely lit, inverted in a dream. Remember the moose outside the tent in Idaho? The moonlight and mosquitoes? How she looked like a boulder in the creek until she lifted her great head from the water, big worldly angel, and turned to look at you with ropes of weeds hanging from her mouth. By day, she strolled among the park's swing sets and jungle gyms, stopping to sniff the dull shine of a slide, stopping high as a house in some child's eye. Parents, sensing danger, tried to shoo her away, but she followed her own calling. Nearly blind after the sun went down, street lights and house lights surrounded her. They found her on the Newsom's front porch. No, excuse me, I messed up a line here. Street lights and house lights surrounded her, a confusion of moons. She must have picked one to lead her on. They found her on the Newsom's front porch, snout pressed against the wall, back legs splayed. Terrified, someone said, as neighbors gathered to watch the wildlife officials load their darts and end her urban visit in a sudden blur of drugs. Think of Golden Gate Park half a life ago, a day of dancing and chanting. Thousands of hairy kids, men, women, dogs with beads and dirty bandanas, a fog of breath and marijuana pulsing around black banks of speakers, blasting the twilight with drumbeat and guitar shrieks. Someone smiling hands you a hit of something. You walk off across a baseball diamond towards some tree or siren or patch of grass looking for your country. A shock-eyed man marches barefoot, mouthing a manic recitation like a fuse burning. You walk and walk into dark and stare at the moon until it comes down and covers your face with its bowl of white light. After the drugs took hold, the drugs wore off. They loaded her on a truck, gently as they could, drove her out of town on dirt roads, lifted her down into high grass, waited to see her waken. Think of leaving and coming back. Think what you have nurtured and betrayed. Think of the towns and cities you changed with your absence. Think of the country. Remember the moose turning away, lowering her head into the water, leaving you the after image, unspoken words, weeds hanging from your mouth. Remember waking in a colder place, glad to breathe and see your breath. I'm going to read I think I'll do like five more poems. And a couple of these poems I'm going to do are a project I'm working on currently with a friend of mine. I'm using a form called the Ghazal or Ghazal, and it's a Persian Arabic form in which there are rhyming couplets, and the first two lines rhyme, and then the alternate lines rhyme. And I've got a correspondence going with Deborah Kang Dean, and she writes one of these ghazals, and then I take part of the last line of the one she wrote, and I start one, and I send it back to her. Our ambition is to put together a book of these, a collection of these things. So I'm going to read you a couple of these ghazals mixed in with these other poems. This one is called Glass Bird. I like this form because it's a kind of lyric form, and it takes me away from my natural inclination, which is to write narrative. This is called Glass Bird. All right. When I woke, released from a dream, a bird, a robin, threw itself at the reflected image of a bird in the east window. The sun rose, and the dream faded into a bird, a confused bird defending its territory from itself, an image in the glass of a bird, a red-breasted bird, moving to meet the challenge of the intruder, the glass bird, a bird only in a bird's mind, until I closed my eyes and drifted back to sleep and dreamed myself a bird. Isn't that a good word, bird? I love that. All right. I hope I didn't wear it out. And I'll read you a poem from American Flamingo. And this is, I think of family is a theme in my work. And it's a theme that connects with a larger theme, which is our connection to community, the way we all relate together, the way in some ways we are all family. And I also write about work. I try to write about the idea of including the difficulties in the work, including those things that don't seem very poetic in my poetry as much as I can. So this starts off as pretty unpoetic, right? It's called Snowstorm, Washington, D.C., And it's sort of it's like I think of it as a narration and a meditation kind of blended together. Washington, D.C. And this is when this was a big snowstorm in Washington, D.C. at the time when they were working on the when they had the scaffolding up on the Washington Monument and things were being fixed. The taxi driver from Sierra Leone who missed his home but doubted he would ever go back, maneuvered the cab on its bald tires in the snow and slush like a fish through the sparse traffic from Washington Circle to the Museum of Natural History. The people in charge of my country, he said, are killers. He left me standing on the curb in the snow, thinking, he can't go home. This man from the Lion Mountains driving away in a taxi on the icy streets of D.C. And though I wanted to see the great upthrust tusks of the mammoth and feel something of the tidal pull of time outside the small hotel room where I'd been working, reading and commenting on other people's writing, one woman whose name stayed with me, Mamuna Silla from Sierra Leone, who wrote gracefully about her arranged marriage that involved a whole village, her immigration to New York, her subsequent divorce. Though I wanted to rest my eyes on fossils and bones, gaze at dioramas, ease away a while from the human, a security guard and a snowplow driver welcomed me into the museum's vestibule with the news the museum was closed. Whole government's shut down, one said. And the other joked, they knew you was coming, man. Snow piled on the shoulders of Rochambeau, on the blowing cape sculpted in bronze of the woman I thought Mamuna Silla, standing with her left hand full of banners and in her right hand a sword, who seemed to be guarding the guardian eagle of the Republic, which might as well have been a lion. And snow piled on the wide green leaves of a magnolia, protected between buildings from the wind. Hours, it seemed, her name, Mamuna Silla, accompanied me on my walk through the storm. I stopped to watch the Washington Monument dressed in scaffolding, its spire fading and sharpening in sheets of blowing snow. Closer on the curb, under a big mound of trash bags, plastic bottles tied with string, overlaid with cardboard, carpet scraps, and snow. Under all this, waiting out the storm, I supposed the dream of freedom persisted. And the snow blowing and drifting, holding this hostage face down on the curb, settled softly all around against stone walls. And here's another, just a couple more poems here. This is another guzzle that the first line plays off of one of Deborah Kangdean's lines. This one's called Dog. That's another good word. Dog. I love that word. Come back, his master calls, breathless to the dog. The wind blows his voice away. Away goes the dog. I have tried in dreams to find you, conjured your touch, your scent, wandering like a lost dog. They carried away what they could as the waters rose. No room in the truck for the dog. Bogalusa to Baghdad, Juarez to Jerusalem. Who feeds the nameless dog? God is great. God is small. open the envelope, pet the dog. And then I'll do... let's see. I'll do two more. Dog. This is about a dog, this next one here. This comes from a long poem called Elegy for the Duke of Earl. And I never want to read it because I have to sing in it. And I'm not a good singer. I can't carry a tune. So I just read those parts that I don't have to sing. All right. I put in italics what I have to sing, and I figured it's better to leave that to the imagination of the reader. Mm-hmm. This is section called The Flying Red Horse, and it's about, I'll just read it. It was a nice old two-story house, four or five of us rented for $75 a month. The neighborhood was condemned to make room for a new freeway. We were a free-flowing family of transients, soldiers back from the war, musicians, students, dogs. We were known for our parties. We took in strays. We bought rice in 50-pound sacks, beer by the case. We had a male basset hound named Crash. And once, when our neighbor's poodle across the street came into heat, we put Crash in an upstairs bedroom, closed the door, but left the windows open. A few of us were leaning on someone's car in the street when Crash came out the window, sniffed the air, whined, and began to pace back and forth along the roof above the porch. Before anyone could get to him, he leapt from the roof. I can still see him in the air like the flying red horse above the mobile station. His deep chest, short legs, long ears straight up, and the wild look in his eye. He came down right on the points of the picket fence, took out two boards, gashed his belly, let out a howl, stood up, shook himself, and headed across the street, oblivious to his bleeding. We all laughed. That was how we lived then. And I'll end with another work poem. Small Pleasures. Small Pleasures, Mojave Desert, California. All right. This is our lunch break from this job that I had a long time ago, and I'm reimagining this lunch break, and it's really hot out here. Noon, 114 degrees. No breeze except the breeze we make going 10 miles an hour in the pickup. No road, just open, flat desert, low brush and scattered rock. The Mojave, somewhere west of Edwards Air Force Base. We're eating our sandwiches, the boss and I, drinking cups of cold water from the thermos jug on the seat between us. We carry 3 gallons of water for each man to get us through to 4 o'clock when we head for cold beer at the bar. He hasn't said anything for some time, just chews and drinks, chews and drinks, stares out at the heat waves as the pickup bumps along, covered with dust and oil. We've been out here since 5 a.m., working on the road. Now we're leaving the road behind. Last night, stopped at a phone booth on the way to the motel. I watched moths swarm at the light while he tried to call home, was it? Something was wrong. bad connection, something. He got angry, yanked the phone off the cord, and threw it on the ground. He didn't try to explain, and I didn't ask. We went to our rooms and slept. We finished our lunch and cigarettes. I look over, thinking to say something about how a day like this makes one appreciate small pleasures. A little shade, this cushioned seat, a cold tomato with salt. But his 50-year-old eyes are closed, his head fallen to one side, mouth open, hands in his lap, no longer steering. Out here, it doesn't seem to matter. Even the snakes, tortoises, and horned lizards are underground. It's a big desert, and we're all alone. I lean back, close my eyes. This too is a pleasure, moving off into the open where the work is never done. Thank you. Can we take a little break? Is that it?
Thanks, Greg. Sounds like that one of those dogs got in the PA system. I almost hear it licking. Anyway, we'll be right back with Ruth Ellen Coker. We're going to take about 5 to 10 minute break. Greg's book is for sale right over there, and we'll be right back in 5 minutes.